I was thinking in terms of risk-taking tonight. We'll start the reflection or the teaching with one modality that I rarely use, and the second one I've never used. So feel free to get up and flee now. But why not? You know, this whole spiritual path is just one risk after another. It doesn't have to be frightening. It can be enlivening, enriched with possibility. So the first piece is a Dharma joke that I was just told today, and it requires a little bit of a backstory, which is we need to know a bit about the translation from Pali into English. So the word anicca means impermanence. The word dukkha means unsatisfactory. And the word anatta means not self or not personal. I know some of you know that, and some of you it's helpful to have a refresher. So that is not the topic of the talk tonight, but it was my greatest laugh of the day today. And I was in a meeting with somebody, and they shared this that somebody had shared with them. So it's a classic joke, and I don't tell jokes like this. It's very unusual. But three folks walked into a bar, and it was a dive. And Dukkha said, "This bar sucks." And Anicca said, "Don't worry, you know, it'll pass, we'll leave." And then Natta said, "Who's got a problem with the bar?" And I just chuckled. I was like, that's really cute. And you could only tell that joke in Dharma community. If I went and told that somebody else that didn't practice meditation in our form, they would look at me, well, I don't know. Those of you that are new might look at me that way. So, okay, it got a chuckle. It certainly made me chuckle. The second piece is actually an example from our political world. And it's not something that I bring in so often and probably wouldn't bring this into a retreat, but practice is everywhere. And one of my great interests is actually having the eyes to see that practice is everywhere. So it's a political example. And I want to acknowledge that we're at the end of a month of exploration here at SIM in working with the difficult, or practicing in particular with difficult emotions, but in a wider sense, working with the difficult. And so when I talked to Rich and I said, well, when I was here in June, we talked about loving kindness for the difficult person. And at the end of the time, I said, would you like some more on this theme? And you all said yes. You all that were here said yes. So there'll be something about that tonight. And weaving in with our kind of greater theme of practicing with the difficult and difficult emotions in particular. But this is where the external and the internal blend. So last night, I don't know how many of you either have a television subscription or went on YouTube like I did and discovered that somebody was streaming the second Democratic debate or the Republican debate on the economy. So I caught the tail end of it. And I caught part of the Democratic debate earlier this month. And, you know, it's just like touching in, touching in. We don't need to drown in this stuff, but we don't need to avoid it completely. Somewhere in the middle is where we can dwell. So I caught the tail end of it. And there were a lot of candidates up there. Didn't even get a chance to actually count how many there were at this point, maybe 11. And they were doing their closing comments, which were 30 seconds long. And sure enough, it gets to Donald Trump. Okay, so notice your mind as I bring in Donald Trump into a Dharma talk. This is definitely a first, perhaps a last. And it's time for his closing comments. His pith, you know, what are closing comments really? It's like the headlines of what these candidates, what's the essence of their being that they want to convey to the American people, right? Mm-hmm. That's a different way of holding it. And so he launches into a story about how the debate was going to be 3.5 hours long. And he and Ben Carson managed to decrease it, working with the television statement, to just 2 hours. And he was pointing to what he said was something like, in 2 minutes, we were able to carve this retreat or this debate from 3.5 hours to 2 hours. And he was saying this as a metaphor for how he would work with the government of the United States of America. And just carve it down to size, right? And so, and everybody laughed, and he had his moment. And then one of the hosts, right before they went into the next person, I'm sure some of you saw this, jumped in and made this little comment. And the little comment was, actually, we were always planning to have it be 2 hours. Okay? So, in theory, this completely debunked what Mr. Trump had just said. He said, you know, I single-handedly made it from 3.5 hours to 2 hours. And then there's this little comment, actually, it was always going to be 2 hours. Now, we have to remember as we're listening to this story, basic premise in our spiritual path, which is, it's not about the object. We can get obsessed in the content of this story. We can get obsessed in the content of the stories of our own minds. It's not about that. It's about, where is the learning? Where's the illumination? Where's the truth in this? What can be revealed through this? And so the very next thing that happened after the host said, actually, it was always going to be 2 hours, is Donald Trump manifested perfectly as Donald Trump. And he blustered and he yelled out, you're wrong! This is wrong! I can't believe this! And he threw this little 15-second fit, which, you know, is a habit of his. It's a habit of all of us. It's just we don't all blast it out over the television airwaves. For a lot of us, it's an internal experience. So let's look at where the teaching is here. Because, in fact, what I immediately got curious about was the television host. And I don't know his name. I'm not caught up with all this stuff. But I thought, huh, here's this man whose job it is to host and hold the integrity of this debate. And here's somebody that just said something that, according to the host, was wrong. We could even say it's a lie. I don't know if it's a lie. It doesn't matter if it's a lie. But here you are in this position as the host with responsibility with a difficult situation in front of you. And perhaps we could say a difficult person for that host in that moment in front of them. Like, what are you going to do when somebody does something like that? And whatever came together for that host, he chose to actually state the truth in a very simple way. Now, there was a slight near miss on it, and the reason I say that is because I could feel the charge in the host's voice. So it wasn't completely quantumous. It wasn't completely balanced and steady and at ease. And yet, even though it wasn't perfectly steady and balanced and at ease, he still chose to speak the truth as he understood it so that the American people could hear that side of it too. Now again, I have no idea what's true or not. It doesn't actually matter. What matters is the practice of this. How was he able to speak that moment of truth in the face of difficulty as he understood it? That's the real question. And it's a question that happens internally and externally. Because let's take it internally. So we'll go to the Anatta voice, right? Whose problem is it anyway? And we're sitting, meditating, or we're on a retreat, or we're living our lives. Everything's going as it always does. And all of a sudden, there's this different kind of thought, which is, huh, that thing that I'm taking so personally isn't. And there's this pause. And there was a pause. It was so brief. It was a nanosecond between the host's comment and Donald Trump's freak out. It would have been so easily missed. If I wasn't a meditator, I would never have noticed it. There was this little pause before the freak out happened. It was that same pause when we suddenly break the trance of the solid, separate sense of self. Me is the main event. And it gets broken, and there's a pause, and then the blustering begins, and the mind throws up its entire fit internally. What do you mean it's not personal? This is happening to me. This is really difficult. You know, and we make our case for why the truth-telling in the mind isn't really so. How many people have had a moment like this? Who's curious? Show of hands, right? Okay, a lot of people. Right? Two hands. We've noticed it a lot. Okay, so this is where these moments in the external world that just feel like they have nothing to do with the spiritual path, have everything to do with the spiritual path. Because if it's not about the object as the main event, it's not about the content as the main event, then we can start to look at the process of things and how everything is a metaphor if we have the eyes to see. So in terms of the metta, or the loving kindness with the difficult, I wanted to approach one of the stories from the time of the Buddha that I've told before. I'll tell again, but from a very particular vantage point, again as a metaphor. And I was reflecting on this in relation to Doug's teaching last week, where he was talking about being a child and going out into the waves down in, I don't know whether it's Baja, Mexico, somewhere, and how the waves are coming, the big waves, and you go under. You go under the waves as an approach, right? Literally and spiritually. And how do we find that space to go under the torrent that could so easily wipe us out and take us away? You know, take us away from the moment, take us away from our integrity, take us away from integrity, authenticity, all of this. So the story is the story of how metta came to be taught. And it's a group of monastics who are going off on their annual rains retreat, right? So in India, there is monsoon that in a lot of parts of India, or at least let's talk about northern India because this is where it takes place, comes in around June 15th, leaves around September 15th. And during that time to this day, it's really hard to travel. It's torrential rain. It's the kind of rain that we're hoping for this winter and fearing for this winter in California, right? I can really feel the push-pull in my own being. You know, how much like the being is calling for that monsoon and how much it's going, oh my gosh, I hope everything's going to be okay. Whatever that means. So during the monsoon, the Buddha would send everybody, including himself, into rains retreat for 3 months. This particular group of monastics went up into the foothills of the Himalayas. And we know that the foothills of the Himalayas are about 8,000 feet high. Just gives a perspective. And they found a place that was ideal. They found a community who would support them, not just with food, but would even build them little cottages to meditate in. There was a beautiful woods. And they thought, like we have thought so many times, this is the perfect place to meditate. You know, you and your house before your neighbor starts their lawnmower. This is the perfect place to meditate. And so they began their meditation. And when conditions are ideal, they're temporary, but there tends to be kind of this ease that's available, and it lends to benevolence with difficulty, whether the difficulty is internal or external. And so when the devas, or the unseen beings who are inhabiting these woods, who discovered that the monastics were not just going to stay for a few days like relatives for Thanksgiving, but in fact they were moving in for a long period of time, they got upset. And they started to try to get rid of these monastics. It's kind of like when we have a moment of emotional dis-ease, whatever your favorite flavor is, and you go, oh, anxiety. It's like, okay. But then it keeps going up. It's like the first moment of anxiety is okay. Then it keeps going up, and you go, how long is this anxiety going to last? So the devas were doing that in relation to monastics. They started to do all their strategies to get rid of the problem, the same way we do when we're not using tools. And so they tried a lot of things. They tried things like scary noises, the branch that cracks in the night when you're backpacking. Okay. They tried stinky smells. Oh my gosh. I'm sad to say, I live in the country, and so some critter got into the bottom of my house and didn't make it.
And it must be rather large critter because it has been smelling and smelling and smelling for about 6 weeks now. And it like dissipates and then it gets worse and then it dissipates. And I thought about that in relation to the monks with these unseen beings creating smells. Because it's interesting, when our sense doors are bombarded with something unpleasant, at first, if we have some mindfulness training, we go, okay, it's just like this. And then we start bargaining with experience. Okay, I can handle this because I'm leaving the house in an hour. And then we come back in another hour and it's still there. And at some point, we just go with our internal world, our external world, enough! I can't take this anymore. I have to buy something, find this animal, shift something. Right? And how do we call up the equanimity to actually buy the something and look for the little critter and take care of it? Because obviously it needs attention. It's a big question, working with the difficult. So the thing that finally freaked out the monastics were, you don't have to believe this, you can hold it metaphorically, the devas created scary thoughts in the monastics' minds. Okay. And the monastics had a moment that I don't usually talk about in the story. Usually when I tell this story, I say the monastics got scared, they ran down the hill and said, "Teacher, teacher, it's too scary, it's too smelly, it's too everything, I can't do this meditation, help me." But really, before they ran down the foothills of the Himalayas and found their teacher, who happened to be the Buddha, there was a moment that's pivotal to look at in terms of our relationship with the difficult inside our own minds and hearts. And it's that moment where you give up. Okay? So there was some moment they had where they just couldn't take it anymore and they gave up. There's different ways of looking at this. You know, maybe yours is fear or anger or self-hatred. There are these difficult ones, right? These moments when we give up. On one hand, we could go, oh, giving up. From the premise of American culture, that's a bad thing, right? We don't want to give up. It's interesting, actually, the other thing Donald Trump said in that little speech, I hadn't thought about it, is he went on a big kind of line about how America doesn't win anymore. Mm-hmm. And it was definitely a negative thing. In his view, that America doesn't win anymore. So we're very, very hardwired in this culture to win, to get it right. What happens when what's going on in our hearts and our minds is so hard that we have a moment of giving up? So part of it could be a collapse, okay? Part of it could be that. Part of it could even be a moment of like collapsing and then either denial or numbness or the protection goes up. And a lot of times when the protection goes up, we lose some awareness. We're not as intimate with the experience because that's part of the protection's job. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just its job. But another way of looking at giving up, in part, a lot of people are familiar with this from the 12-step tradition, and it's talked about as hitting bottom. Now, hitting bottom isn't necessarily a bad thing. It means that actually we've fought the good fight and taken this mess inside ourselves as far as we can take it, and it's just not going to go any further. And when we can really, really say, I give up, it's over, I'm not going to play this game anymore, then there's the opportunity for something new to arise, a new thought, a new opportunity. Actually, we could look at Siddhartha's story of awakening that way. You know, one of his pivotal moments of hitting bottom or giving up happened after he had spent years doing very strict practices, including starving himself, so he almost died. And at a certain point, when his body was on death's door, he gave up. Not the way that we think about giving up necessarily, but he gave up, he hit a bottom. And out of that bottom, a thought arose that he hadn't had before that changed everything. And the thought is one that I drop in to this mind stream all the time. The thought was, this isn't working. Might there be another way? Boom. We move from the box of me and how it is and how it always will be into something mysterious, unknown, and fresh.
And that led him to take a risk and have sustenance. It led him to the tree. It led him to make the resolve, I will sit here until I wake up or die, and mean it. And, of course, he got a happy ending of the story, which is why we know the story. I'm kind of curious about all the ones that did something like that and sat under the tree and died. I mean, maybe that sounds kind of grim, but you know it happened. You know it happened. And there's stories about that in Thailand. You know, they'd find these monastics in the cave, and they didn't make it. They didn't make it. But it doesn't mean they didn't practice well. It doesn't mean they didn't give their whole heart to what they cared about most of anything. If we know we don't have a lot of life left, how are we going to give ourselves to the moment? Now, the truth is, we don't have a lot of life left, so how are we going to give ourselves to the moment? So the monastics gave up. And they ran down the hill to get their teacher. This is the wrong place. It's too stinky. It's too scary. It's too this. It's too that. This is not a conducive place for meditation, much less awakening. And the Buddha saw something else. And really what he saw, what he said to them is, friends, this is a perfect place to go meditate. Go back, go back. Have I got a practice for you? Loving kindness. And he taught them the whole practice. But really, we can be the voice of the Buddha in ourselves. When we hit that bottom and we just say, wow, it's too hard inside. Too depressed, too whatever it is. Or we're dealing with somebody and it's just gotten a little bit complicated. We can have that same voice and say, there are tools, there are resources. What are they? We can reach out for help the way the monastics did. We can gather together in community the way that the monastics did. We can try again, which is so in the spirit of that story that I sometimes tell about the young man with the tattoos on his hands, and the tattoos say, I love you, keep going. I love you, keep going. And we keep going. Breath by breath. One of the simplest practices I have for those moments inside myself is, whoa, this is too much inside. And as soon as that's identified in the wisdom of that, I ask myself this question, can I take 3 breaths with what's happening? And sometimes the answer, in all honesty, is absolutely not. I cannot take 3 breaths with what's happening right now. And then I say to myself with all compassion, okay, can you take 1? And very, very often, if 3 are not available, 1 is. And here's the interesting thing. Is that even if the answer is no, not even 1, somehow the nervous system still causes the whole body to come together and take a breath, and there's some awareness of it, even in realizing I can't breathe with it. The breath is happening anyway. Okay, it's already happening. The ally is already there. And that's the story of the opening into the whole tradition of metta. And it's the most important part of the story, the part that's to come. The monastics went back up on the mountain and they continued their practice. And we don't know exactly how they did it, but the way that the teaching's been woven over the years since then is that for many of us, we use intentional phrases of inclining the mind towards benevolence and goodwill and friendliness. And so maybe they said something to themselves like, may I be protected and safe. May I be happy. May I be healthy and strong. And may I live with ease. Out of the Metta Sutta, we get wishing in gladness and in safety. May all beings be at ease. So something like that. And what we know from the story is that the unseen beings, these devas, had a complete transformation out of the field of this metta. And they actually transformed from being the difficulties in the monastic's practice to being the allies. And this is the part of the story I'm the most interested in. How do we transform the difficulty into being an ally? And it's often very, very simple things. Firstly, being able to identify there's a difficulty. Let's not discount that.
Because otherwise we're in denial about what's happening. Being able to ask for help. Being able to move out of isolation and reach out. Whether it's community, any type of community, whether it's asking for support, whether it's going online and listening to yet another Dharma talk. I'll share with you something. I can't listen to Dharma talks anymore. I'm taking a break. So now when I want to hear really, really good Dharma, and of course I love listening to my colleagues that I teach with on retreat. I learn a lot from them. But when I want to hear really good Dharma these days, I actually go online and I don't go to Dharma Seed, but I'll go to different websites that I've become familiar with over this last year that I've been taking a Dharma talk break and going, where is the Dharma in this talk? Where is the Dharma in this talk? And I think that allowed me to see the Dharma in Donald Trump's talk. You know, it's available. Anyway, Dharma talks are a great, great resource. I think I just overdid it all these years. Anyway, so we're transforming the difficulty into an ally. That really is the way I'm thinking about this image again from Doug's talk of diving under the waves. It's like these emotions. Some traditions they're called, all emotions are called afflictive, which can seem kind of grim. What about happiness? What about peace? What about just excitement? Beautiful states of mind. Are they afflictive? Well, only in the sense of we get a little bit tied to having them continue and increase. And when they decrease and fall away, then we've got a problem and we're struggling and we're grasping after the next moment of the way we want it to be, right? So in that sense, we could say, oh, we get afflicted with these emotions. It doesn't mean we can't be in relationship with them, though. And that's a beautiful thing. We're really not trying to get rid of anything in this practice. Things do transform into different facets and different faces. My own journey with fear has been so instrumental with that. When I first started meditation practice, I was quite afraid. And I could build a case for why I was afraid, and you would believe me and go, yeah, that's a good reason to be afraid. Okay, so that's the content. But the actual experience of being me in my younger years of practice, in my late teens and early 20s, was that I was plagued, I was afflicted by a lot of fear. And when the field of the mind starts to get afflicted with a lot of anything like fear, or maybe anger is your thing, or resentment, whatever it is, it's easier to trigger it off. Lots of different things can become a muse for that fear that wouldn't necessarily have before, because it's just a groove that's there. It's built. So there's a lot of fear. In my early years of retreat, I would just sit there on the cushion and just was terrified. And one of the stories that really helps me work with that is actually yet another story from the Buddha. There's a story of the Buddha practicing with Mara, right? And we know that Mara represents, in the archetypal kind of canon, everything that's difficult. The one that's going to take us off the path. The one that's going to take us out of ourselves and who we really, really are. And I love Thich Nhat Hanh's interpretation of the Mara stories. And the way that he tells them is that both before the Buddha was enlightened, and to me this is so important, after the Buddha was enlightened also, Mara would come and visit. And so this particular story is after the Buddha's enlightenment. Now you can hold Mara as an actual being, or you can hold Mara as your worst difficult emotion or difficult person or difficult situation in your life. It works the same both ways. So here's the Buddha seated in meditation, minding his own business, experiencing the bliss of Nibbana, or whatever it was that he was doing. And knock, 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 here comes Mara. Ananda, his cousin, who was his attendant for many, many years, intervenes and says, Mara, what are you doing here? And Mara said, well, I'm here to visit the Buddha. And my mom says, well, you can't visit the Buddha. He's busy meditating right now. And the Buddha hears this conversation. He says, who's out there, Ananda? And Ananda says, oh, it's nobody. Right? I mean, we do that sometimes when a difficult emotion's coming in. Right? What's going on? Oh, it's nothing. I'll just do the next thing on my to-do list. And in fact, something's knocking on the door. And the Buddha says, nobody, I heard you having a conversation. Ananda says, oh, well, actually, it's Mara, but don't worry, he's going away. And the Buddha says, no, Mara, my good friend, please invite him in. And Mara comes in, and they have a chat. And the chat goes something like, Mara coming in and going, oh, you know, I've come here to see you, you know, Buddha, who do you think you are meditating? You don't even accept guests. And going on and on, the way that our judgmental mind can go on and on. I'm not the only one, right? Judgmental mind. Okay, so it starts like that. And the Buddha goes, oh, yeah, you know, I almost missed you. You're right. Yeah, and then Mara continues. Well, you know, I don't know who you think you are being a Buddha. I mean, do you really think you're enlightened? Have you fooled all these people into thinking that you're fully enlightened? And the Buddha says, yeah, huh, you got a point. You know, let's pour some tea and talk about this. And so he pulls out the tea, and he pours some tea, and says, huh, yeah, everybody thinks I'm enlightened. You don't think I'm enlightened. That's interesting. Tell me more. Well, you know, I think that there must be some flicker of something left that isn't completely enlightened in you, Buddha. Huh? Really? Here. Do you want a lump of sugar in your tea, Mara? Here. Right? It's friendly. Okay? And so they continue. And at some point, through that witnessing, and it's a witnessing that can happen internally or externally, Mara starts to transform. Or we could say a different side of Mara has the space to be revealed. And this side of Mara sounds a little bit different. He says to the Buddha, well, you know, actually, the Buddha says, well, so how are you doing, Mara? Tell me what's going on. Catch me up. And Mara says, well, actually, I'm not doing so well. And it's kind of hard being a Mara. People don't like me. They send me away. They act like I don't exist. It's not really so easy being a Mara. And the Buddha says, oh, Mara, I completely hear you. It's not so easy being a Buddha. You know, my own cousin tried to kill me, and people disagree with me. They say that I lie. You know, I try to prevent these wars, and the wars happen anyway. It's not so easy being a Buddha either. Here, have a cookie. That'll help. This is one of the tellings. And so I just imagine the Buddha sitting there, and Mara sitting there, and Mara's chewing on the cookie, and the Buddha probably isn't, because Buddhas don't really eat between meal times. But they still offered the Mara cookie. And just sitting there and breathing together and smiling and going, yeah, not easy. And you just feel the warmth and the connection. And so I really use that story with the fear. And I used it in a very simple way. I'm sure not the only one who's used it that way. When the fear would come, and I could just feel it coursing through my whole body. It was like the hairs would stand on end, and I wanted to turn and see if somebody was about to take me out, even though I knew I was in a meditation hall. And the associated thoughts would come, and the emotions would come, and I'd get bigger and bigger and bigger. And then at some point, I'd remember to identify. And then with all the love in my heart and the benevolence in my heart, say, oh, I see you, Mara. I see you. And in fact, so many stories of the Buddha and Mara, that was the punchline. Mara, I see you. And Mara, often at that point, would slink away. But if I think about that metaphorically, for me what would happen is the fear would have a bigger corral to run around in. It was like a created space. You know how I've got horses down the street from my house, and there's a small corral and a big corral, and when they don't have enough space in the small corral, they get really riled up. You know, you can just sense their agitation. But when the owner opens up the gate so that they have this whole field, It's like they can just run around and be all riled up and settle down and have enough space for it. I See You, Mara opens up that space and then reminds us of other tools like, oh, maybe I need to ground. This is difficult. Maybe I can take 3 breaths. Maybe I can say to myself, wishing in gladness and in safety, may I be at ease. Even if I don't even know what that word means in the moment, may I be at ease anyway. So sometimes that practice happens internally. Sometimes it happens externally. And my favorite story about it happening externally is a story about Gandhi working with the British during that period of time in India. And Gandhi, there was a famous incident where Gandhi had tea with a top official, and they did not agree. There was very, very little that they agreed about the future of India and the Indian people. But Gandhi invited this man to tea. And at first the man didn't want to come to tea, this official, but eventually he was convinced and he came to tea. And Gandhi invited him in, was extremely gracious, asked after his family. What if we did that when anger came? Like, oh, here you are. Tell me your story. Let me hold this in awareness. Okay? So there's enough space that it's actually held in awareness. It's not obsession with the content. It's saying, let the story be revealed so it doesn't have to have the same charge to run my life. So they sat down to tea, these two men. Gandhi asked about his family. At some point, the man asked about Gandhi's family. Because when we're in the presence of kindness, it inspires kindness. Sometimes it takes an awful long time. Well, sometimes it doesn't look like much. But at some point, it's contagious. And so they asked about each other's families, and they sipped tea, and they talked, and they sipped tea, and they talked about India, about the future of India, about the government of India, about what needed to happen. Okay? And at one point they reached an impasse where they could not find anything in common. And the official got up to leave. Forget it, it's over. And Gandhi said, no, please, have another cup of tea. They sat down again and they had some more tea. And out of the conversation that emerged, they came to some conclusions that actually led to some further steps on behalf of the British, on behalf of the emerging Indian government, that led to things that needed to happen. It's that patience, it's that willingness to sit with someone or something that we don't like, that we don't agree with. But, you know, if we're really hungry, or we're really tired, or we've just had the worst week of our lives, that wouldn't be the right time to invite our difficult person to tea in person, or to invite the most difficult emotion we have in our being to shine forth and tell us its story, because we don't have the capacity then. So we've got to be wise about conditions, right? The whole thing coming together with causes and conditions. The last thing I'm thinking about is the incident of the Buddha and the Buddha and the mad elephant. Yeah. Right, Nalagiri. So this one's interesting to me in terms of tools. A family member who was angry at his cousin the Buddha hired somebody to release a mad elephant in the town where the Buddha was walking for alms, for food, to kill him. Okay, you think you got problems with your family? I'm sure you do. So did the Buddha. Okay. So this elephant got released, Nalagiri, and the elephant starts charging down the road. And the first thing that happens is that everybody tries to pull the Buddha out of the way so he won't be harmed. And the Buddha says, no, no, don't worry, I won't be harmed. And so the next thing that happens is that everybody scatters to save themselves. Okay? So that's like on airplanes. You put the mask on somebody else and then yourself. here, Buddha, let me help you to the side of the road and get some oxygen. No, I'm fine. I've got enough oxygen. Okay, well, let me put my own oxygen on. I need some. I can't handle it in the face of this elephant. Okay. And so the elephant's coming, and the Buddha is just standing there. Just standing there. And through the force of the radiation of his metta, of his benevolence and his friendliness and his love, a transformation happens. That which was about to take him out. So now I'm thinking about the wave again. Now we're standing there and there's a wave coming. And we're about to be taken out. How do we dive underneath? Here's one way to dive underneath. We don't need to be the Buddha. But through the force of that, what happened with Nalagiri was Nalagiri started slowing down. And then Nalagiri stopped. And then Nalagiri, the elephant, bowed down to the Buddha. And the Buddha smiled, and all was well. The end. But when I think about us and we're about to be wiped out, I was talking to somebody recently, and they said, you know, this thing happened to me the other day, and I felt like I had been hit in the solar plexus. And I was talking to somebody else few days before that, and they said, wow, this thing happened, and I felt like I had been taken out by a tsunami. It feels that way energetically sometimes in our relationships, in our life circumstances. We get the phone call we never wanted to get, whatever it is. Or we're just sitting there minding our own business, and the fear comes. And yes, there's some proximate cause, but really, are we really going to buy into the proximate cause? Maybe a little bit, but not completely. It's the fear coming. It's just the fear coming. And so think about what it might have taken for the Buddha to radiate that kind of force of benevolence. First, it takes ground. We talk a lot about ground when I'm here. The piece about grounding, using the earth as a refuge, it's greater than our small, contracted sense of self. The grounding on the earth as an anchor. Not theoretically, but like right now, you don't have to change your posture. Feel the connection of the weight on the chair, of the feet on the ground. It's like, oh, right. There needed to be a tremendous groundedness. Okay. There needed to be fearlessness. And we have moments where the fear breaks in the face of difficulty. They may be as short as the pause between the host's statement, it isn't true, and Donald Trump's freak out. It might be that quick, which means we miss it. But just a moment where the fear isn't so far in the foreground. Just relaxes for a moment like the fist we can't hold on anymore before it re-grabs. We can track for this. The same way we track for the pauses in between the thoughts while we're meditating. It feels like it's all thoughts, and in fact, there's a lot of space and pause there. We can start to orient to that. So then we've got groundedness. We've got fearlessness. We've got spaciousness. We've got intention and trust. The Buddha completely trusted the ability of his particular manifestation of a mind stream to be able to radiate this kindness in a way that could transform. What if we were that bold and courageous with our own difficult emotions? May it be transformed. Period. Yes, all the stories about why it can't in my history and on and on and on. And may it be transformed anyway. Anyway. He had that kind of confidence, that trust, and that inclination of mind that just says, even though, you know how it feels when we fall into a pit of a difficult emotion? And then I often talk about shifting the center of gravity out of the pit into something that's more helpful. It's like, even though there's the pit, still may this be transformed. How often have I worked with youth or people who work with youth? And they'll say, you know, there's this one youth who was really difficult. Everything had gone wrong in their life. And they had done a lot of really, really unskillful things. Could be an adult, too. It's just my history. I was working with youth. And what we discovered is a collective body of people working with youth. is if there was one person, just one, who saw that kid, who saw what they really were, who saw their potential, that was enough to begin to support the transformation that started to call other resources to that same child. So that it was moving in a different direction, inclining in a different direction. So there's the piece about metta, the same phrases, and that's the anchor for the thinking mind, so we don't tell stories about what's for dinner and my shopping list and the email that I have to write when I'm done. The phrases ground us. They give the mind focus and strength. But we all know that the real metta isn't learning how to say phrases well any more than the real insight meditation is learning how to notice breaths well. That's not it. It's the training. We need to train. But the manifestation of metta is a feeling. It shines forth. Sometimes we evoke it from within ourselves. Sometimes the world reflects it back to us. Okay, last story. Full of stories tonight. Another one just popped up. Last week? Yes, last week. Had yet another long day. I'm sure I'm not the only one that has days like that. And it was mid-afternoon, and I had already done a full day's worth of stuff, and it was mid-afternoon. And it was time to get in my car and run some errands and then go teach at Mountain Stream. And the energy just bottomed out. It completely bottomed out. And with it, the mood, just the bottom dropped out of the mood as well. So I could feel the physical energy just dissipating into I don't know where, and then the mood dropping with it. And I'm behind the wheel, and I'm just driving down the road, and the thought comes, as often comes in moments like that, how am I going to get through the rest of the day? Okay, it's just a thought. I've really learned not to believe it. It's an indicator of what's going on in the emotional realm and in the body. Okay, but the thought came. And the very next thing that happened was I saw some people walking down the road that I was driving on. And it was a woman and about a 10-year-old little girl. Long, long blonde hair, like all the way down. About 10 years old, and I immediately made up a story that this was a mother and a child, but I realized later it could have been an auntie and a child or a babysitter and a child, but really who they were to each other wasn't the point. The point was what they were radiating. Okay. These two were on top of the world. Their faces were both lit up in a grin. They were laughing and chatting and chuckling. And this little girl, it was like she was a beacon. She was manifesting in that moment as a beacon. Now, I know that if I knew her well, there'd be another time when she was, you know, frustrated and crying and stomping her foot. But right then, she was a complete beacon of friendliness, joy, and love. And it was so contagious. The next thing that happened was she saw my car. And she looked over and her face lit up like I was her best friend. I have no idea who she was. And she waved. And immediately, like before I even had a like volitional anything, my hand was up and I'm smiling and waving. And I felt it go in. And I kept driving and everything changed. I could literally feel the heart space get warm and full, and all of a sudden the energy started coming back in, and the mood completely shifted, and all that happened was a meeting of the eyes and a wave between strangers. Sometimes we work with our own difficulties, and we need to know how. Sometimes it's allowing the world to buoy us up, just a little girl skipping down the street with somebody that she cares about. So we can be on the lookout for both. That's what I have to offer for reflection. Thank you for your attention.